The Tom Tom Suites, which was built into the steep slope of the hill on which it was constructed, looked more Dutch than Mediterranean in its architecture and reminded Rhys of Cape Town. A young, uniform-clad bellman opened the cab door and welcomed Rhys to the property. Rhys made a show of paying the driver in U.S. bills, leaving a hefty tip. The man smiled and thanked Rhys in vastly improved English, and, seeing the wad of cash, the bellman's eyes lit up too. He scurried to the open trunk to retrieve Rhys's luggage and led him through the hotel's glass-canopied entrance. He stood aside as Rhys approached the front desk, handing him a U.S. $20 bill. "There are a few better ways to attract attention than by throwing money around." The hotel staff were efficient and courteous, obviously pleased by the 10-day reservation. When asked if he needed assistance with his bags, he almost spit out his default "no thank you," but decided that a guy like James Donovan wouldn't mind someone carrying his luggage for him. Another $20 ensured that the staff would remain interested. The spacious room was on the third floor with an amazing view of tiled rooftops, minaret towers, and the churning waters of the Bosphorus. The parquet wooden floors stretched the length of the suite, with a living area arranged at the foot of the king-sized bed. A large, impressionistic painting that appeared to depict the city's skyline hung above the headboard, and through the sliding glass wall that separated it from the living area, he could see that the bathroom was covered in dappled white marble from floor to ceiling. Rhys much preferred his humble hooch in Mozambique. The SEAL-turned-intelligence operative took a small device from his messenger bag that was disguised to look like an external hard drive. It was, in fact, a counter-surveillance device designed to detect hidden listening devices and cameras. There was no reason to suspect that he was under surveillance, government or otherwise, but one didn't make assumptions in this line of work. After sweeping the room without any indication of an active bug, Rhys returned the device to his bag. He entered the 9-digit passcode into his iPhone and sent Freddy a text message. "In room 307, view to the southeast. All good." Within 30 seconds, his phone vibrated. "Good copy. 5 minutes out if you need me." Freddy and the case officer who had driven them from the consulate were set up in a safe house several blocks to the northeast. From their position, they could act as backup in case Rhys ran into trouble and could also feed him information as it came in from local sources and from the various information-gathering assets at the U.S. government's disposal. Their position was close enough to respond in case of an emergency, but far away enough so as not to arouse suspicion. It was time to rely on the time-honored attribute for which snipers were known: patience. Chapter 43. The Arap Mosque sits in a cluttered neighborhood near the river, with multi-story buildings of assorted vintages lining narrow streets. A wider, more modern four-lane thoroughfare runs two blocks to the west, with a parking lane separated by a concrete curb in front of a shopping area that is more Middle Eastern than European. An undeveloped lot sat between two apartment buildings and served as a park for the local residents. A direct path to the mosque would pass right through it. A glade of green grass added some color, and several towering trees provided shade from the midday sun. At 11 o'clock a.m., Rhys found a bench facing the four-lane road, removed his sunglasses, and opened a copy of the Times of London. Foot traffic was light, as most of the residents of this working-class neighborhood were busy working at this hour. A mother scrolled through her smartphone as her 3-year-old daughter played nearby. The child quickly turned her interest to Rhys, staring at him curiously through big brown eyes. He began to play peekaboo with his newspaper, her soft giggles evolving into belly laughs as the duration of his hides lengthened. The child's laughter brought a smile to his face, but sadness to his heart, as he thought of his own daughter, who had never tired of playing the game. "Focus, Rhys." By 11:30 a.m., the volume of traffic increased as men began making their way toward Jumu'ah. The oldest men arrived first. Some traditions seemed to transcend culture. As the noon hour approached, the crowds grew thicker and the worshippers younger. The men ranged from business suit-clad professionals to blue-collar workers in more modest dress. They converged on the steps of the mosque and made their way inside. Nothing out of the ordinary. An hour later, the doors opened and the worshippers descended the steps, returning to the jobs and families awaiting them. Reese stayed seated for another 30 minutes before heading back to the hotel. He spent the afternoon reading and rereading everything that the agency had provided him on Mohammed, including the reports of all his unit's operations. Using an agency VPN developed by a company called Seven Tunnels, he linked to a folder on Dropbox and accessed a seemingly benign music file hidden among thousands of similar files. Just as Freddie had trained him to do in Redacted, he used a Veracrypt encrypted partition hidden within the music file and entered a 26-character password. Nothing was ever downloaded to his computer. Looking over the operations orders and after-action reports from the 10 months that Reese had worked with Mo and his special tactics unit brought back a flood of memories. Their operations had taken place at the height of the insurgency, in some of the worst neighborhoods in Baghdad. Working in conjunction with and alongside Allied Special Operations units, Mo's STU team played a critical role in capturing high-value individuals and rapidly exploiting intelligence to dismantle enemy networks. They had the added benefit of being an entirely Iraqi unit, which gave them some of the best tactical-level intelligence in theater. They also worked for the Iraqi Ministry of the Interior, which put the fear of Allah into those they captured. Iraq's MOI did not give the Geneva and Hague conventions the same weight as their American allies. When Reese returned to the United States and the liaison role transitioned completely to Jules Landry, the scope of the operations shifted. Retaliation seemed to be the motive rather than counterinsurgency. Why would the CIA have kept Landry on after Reese's report on his behavior in Iraq? In Reese's estimation, Landry was not a stable individual and had no business working sensitive intelligence operations. Mo had been the one Iraqi commander who stood head and shoulders above his peers. He excelled in both the planning and tactical execution of direct action missions, spoke English almost fluently, and had the trust of both his men and the senior leadership of the MOI. After Mo's disappearance, the references to his existence became few and far between, all unconfirmed. A mention of one of his aliases on an intercepted phone call emanating from Syria, possible sightings in Greece, and, of course, the intel that had brought Reese to Turkey. The only concrete proof that Mo had left Iraq alive was the photo taken in Italy that Freddie had shown him back in Africa. Are we chasing a ghost? A week had passed, and the routine was beginning to wear on him. At least the hotel had a gym where Reese could crank out some brutal CrossFit and Jim Jones workouts. Each day he followed the same pattern to make it easy for anyone wishing to make contact. He'd wake up, work out, and have breakfast, taking his time to read the paper as he finished his coffee. Then it was a leisurely stroll along the river, eventually ending up outside the Arap Mosque. Still nothing. He wanted to avoid entering the mosque and having to use Majid's lessons. He wasn't sure he could pull it off even if he was going in under the guise of an author doing research for a new novel. He'd give it one more day. If no one made contact with him by then, he'd go the mosque route. At 10 to noon, he saw them. Three men crossing the road toward the park, their heads on swivels. Predators. Two of the men appeared to be in their late 20s, while the third was closer to Reese's age. They each had the broad shoulders of athletes, all wore sunglasses, expensive leather boots, and light jackets. They didn't wear rank or unit insignia, but to Reese's trained eye, it was as if they were in uniform. Reese lowered the newspaper to his lap and stared directly at them as they approached. The older man noticed him as soon as he stepped onto the sidewalk, and by the time they were within 20 yards of the bench, all three were staring holes in him. The posture of the younger men changed from vigilant to combative as they neared Reese's position, chests thrust upward, a swagger in their step, heads held high. Their physical behavior sent a primordial message. This was their territory, and he was an intruder. Could this be Moe's security detail? Reese made sure to hold their stares until they walked completely past him. Message sent. Reese lingered until 12:15 to ensure that Moe wasn't coming, and then walked toward the front of the mosque on his way back to the hotel, noticing a pair of 10-year-old boys tailing him from a block behind. Perfect. He kept a slow and easy pace to ensure they were able to follow him. Back in his room, Reese rechecked for listening devices before calling Freddy at the safe house. He answered immediately. How'd it go? It went. Three guys that looked like they could have been extras in a Chuck Norris movie walked right past me, eyeballing me the whole way. They had a couple of kids follow me home, so I think we set the hook. That's great. Just be careful. Hopefully they are Moe's guys and not just some local thugs. They looked former military. I'll be careful. Good. I've got some news on Landry. A buddy in counterintelligence called and gave me some intel from their initial report. It seems as though young Mr. Landry had a criminal record that the agency didn't know about when they hired him. Besides a couple of simple battery-type arrests as a juvenile, he was arrested for rape during his senior year of high school. Somehow, the case went away. I'm guessing he cut a deal to join the Marines. The counterintelligence division and the IG's office are still looking into it, but the odd part is that someone made it disappear during his screening. It doesn't surprise me that he's a scumbag, but it is weird that he got in the door with that kind of record. See if you can find out who recruited him and who signed off on his background. I'm already on it. Thanks. I'll hit you up at our next comm window. Reese cut the call and looked out his window over the city. Moe was out there somewhere, one of the most highly trained covert operatives in the world. He had become a terrorist, and somehow Landry was involved. Not long ago, they had all depended on one another to survive in battle. Reese couldn't help but think that the next time they met up, not all of them would be walking away. Chapter 44. How would Moe make contact? Reese knew the CIA had given him some of the same training they give the case officers, but Reese's experience with Moe and his unit in Iraq had been of a more kinetic nature. Reese still had a hard time believing that the Iraqi major he'd trusted with his life was now a terrorist, targeting the same Western nations he had fought alongside in the cradle of civilization. Reese needed to get some air. The coffee bar downstairs had proven to be excellent, so he ordered a to-go cup of their lightest roast. After doctoring it with milk and honey, he nodded to the bellman, who held the door for him as he walked out into the afternoon sunshine. The coffee was too hot to drink, so Reese removed the plastic lid and blew on it as he walked along the steep uphill path. With his subconscious mind occupied by the mountain of intelligence documents he'd read, and his conscious focus on the coffee, Reese noticed and then dismissed the maintenance worker clad in bright coveralls as he walked past him. Mistake. 2 seconds later, he heard the pop of the compressed nitrogen and immediately felt the sting of the metal barbs that penetrated his shirt and embedded themselves into the muscle of his upper back. His limbs instantaneously contracted and cramped, as 2,000 volts of electricity surged into his body, dropping him to the sidewalk. His entire body in taut agony, in addition to being burned by the scalding hot coffee. The pain ended nearly as quickly as it began, and he found himself floating above the sidewalk, unable to move his limbs. As his chest hit the floorboard of the Transit Connect delivery van, he realized that he'd been flex-cuffed at both his wrists and ankles. A pillowcase was pulled over his head as the door slid to a close. In a moment of out-of-body clarity, he marveled at how quickly his abductors had planned and executed this operation. It was hot inside the van, and the floor smelled of grease and oil, mixing with the strong odor of the coffee that soaked his shirt. Reese lay still, conserving his energy in case it became necessary to run or fight later, though the objective of the mission was to do neither. Strong hands frisked him from head to toe, covering every inch of his body with no regard for modesty. His subcompact SIG, spare magazine, knife, shoes, and iPhone were taken from him. He assumed that the phone was being placed inside a container that would prevent his location from being tracked. There was no talking among his captors, which made it nearly impossible for him to determine their exact numbers. The driver didn't speed or drive erratically. Instead, he navigated the city's streets as part of the normal flow of traffic, making frequent turns. These men were pros. After what seemed like an hour, but was probably half that, the van stopped. The driver turned off the diesel motor and engaged the parking brake. He heard the sound of chains from outside the van, and a steel service door rolled downward on its tracks. They'd pulled into a garage or warehouse based on the echo of voices in what sounded like Arabic. The van door slid open quickly, and what felt like three men dragged him out by his ankles and stood him upright, his stockinged feet landing on the cold concrete floor. Some type of motor hummed in the background. "Walk," a voice from behind him said in accented English. One man held each arm, and a third had him by the top of the head, guiding him forward and away from the direction of the door. He walked 20 paces before his feet felt the threshold of a door and then thin carpeting. After a few more steps, he could hear the sound of a chair being dragged across the carpet behind him. "Sit." Footsteps shuffled away, and he heard the door shut behind him. He slowed his breathing, settled his heart rate, and concentrated on the plastic restraints that bound his wrists in front of him. In a move that he and his teammates had practiced dozens of times in various SEER courses, Reese pushed his arms up and away from his body, then snapped them down across his abdomen. The plastic gave way to freedom. He rubbed his wrists as the blood rushed into his tingling hands and pulled the cloth away from his head. The room was dark. It was a small office, the kind attached to industrial spaces, with a desk, filing cabinets, and dusty stacks of books and papers on the floor. 10 feet away, he saw a dark couch against the wall, and a shot of adrenaline shot through his body as his brain registered a human figure seated on it. As he rose to his still restrained feet, a flash of light illuminated the room. The flame burned brightly, and as the man inhaled on his cigarette, the light glowed against his bearded face.
"Mo!" Reese shouted.
"James Reese. What on earth are you doing here, my friend?"
Mo said, as he exhaled a cloud of gray smoke and extinguished his lighter. He turned on a lamp, and Reese saw him clearly for the first time. Dashing as ever, Moe's longish black hair was slicked back, his beard precisely cropped, and his clothing impeccable. He stowed the silver lighter into the pocket of his tailored sport coat, rose from his chair, and embraced Reese in a strong hug. Then, drawing an automatic knife from the pocket of his jeans, he dropped to one knee and swiftly cut the plastic binding from Reese's ankles.
"Sit down, sit down."
Mo motioned Reese back into his chair as he turned back toward the couch.
"Sorry about the way my men treated you, but I had to make sure it was really you."
"Well, you could have just called my room."